The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing, described by none other than Mario Andretti as the greatest form of motorsport on the planet. Mario Andretti is apparently a very astute guy, because he's dead right. Today is Friday, August 31st. This is episode number 93, and I am your host, Bob Hayes, here today, as I am every week, to tell you about what's going on in MotoGP. We got a pretty cool show going on this week. We've got some reader email that I'm going to talk about, some responses to last week's editorial. We've got a little story that I'm doing about Miller Motorsport Park and World Superbike. That's kind of good news. We, of course, got our Misano preview. A real quick preview for their Misano race coming up this weekend and MotoGP. And then we got a conversation with Liam Schubert, parts manager for the Dantin Ducati racing team. Frequent guest on the show. We always like having Liam, and he had some great stories and all sorts of stuff. So I think you're going to enjoy that. Before we get to all that, I do want to send a big shout out to several people that sent in donations to the cause of MotoGPOD. Steve Geisler from Australia, Andy Mellor, Paul Laver, and Graham Weeder, all three of those guys from the United Kingdom. So we got one Australian and three guys from the UK donated to MotoGPOD. I do appreciate it a lot, guys. Your donations will help me pay for the bandwidth and postage and just Skype bills, all the things that come up with running a podcast. Appreciate that a lot. Thanks a lot. In the news this past week, I think the most significant thing that we saw in the news was that Anthony West has signed with Kawasaki for next weekend. Or next weekend. He signed for next year. So Ant West is on board for 2008 with Kawasaki. He's going to be teammate with John Hopkins. I think the thing that finalized this was that Randy DiPugna signed with LCR Honda. So that sort of limited Kawasaki's choices and kind of made the decision for them. Not that I'm saying that Ant West is the bad choice or anything like that. And it might have been the other way around. Maybe Randy DiPugna read the writing on the wall and saw that Anthony was going to get the ride. I don't know. It's not. This is not the kind of knowledge that you can get unless you have a really inside track, and even then, it's not likely that you're going to hear it. But it's good news for Ant West, and it's probably good news for Kawasaki, too, because I think he's doing a super good so far this season, having come on so late and everything else, just getting used to the ZXRR, that he's got a lot of potential. And I think he'll be a good teammate for John Hopkins, and looking forward to that. So silly season is shaken out where the music is ending, the musical chairs. You know, some people are going to be left without seats, of course. We'll see the last few things fall into place in the next few weeks, and then the writers can get down to the business of doing their job, which is entertaining us, the fans, by their on-track performances. So one thing I do want to mention about Kawasaki is they send out the best press releases. Their press releases are a little less contrived than some of the other things, and it seems like the quotes from the writers, it might be something that the writer actually said rather than the press person just sort of writing something that they might say in a perfect world. And moving on, speaking of writers doing their jobs and things, one of the jobs that writers have is supporting their sponsors. And I saw a video on MotoGP.com that I thought was worth mentioning on the show because this is kind of a cool thing. Unfortunately, you do have to have a subscription to MotoGP.com. So if you're not paying the money for MotoGP.com, you can't watch this video unless you can find it on YouTube, which I'm sure it's out there, but I haven't looked. But Nicky Hayden made a Michelin commercial, and they had a little behind-the-scenes kind of a thing going on, and I thought it was kind of entertaining. So I'll put a link on the website for that Nicky Hayden commercial, because as Donald Carter pointed out to me, trying to find anything on MotoGP.com is pretty much a nightmare unless you happen to catch it, you know, that week and all that sort of thing. But their old content, there's really no way to find it. Donald Carter asked me about, where's this story about Liam Schubert working in MotoGP? And I had not put a direct link on the website. And I regret that now, because it's pretty much impossible to find unless you Google for it and all of that. So I managed to find the link. I sent it to Donald. I'm going to go ahead and put the link in this one. So if you have not read the story about Liam Schubert working in MotoGP, It's at the MotoGP.com website. It was kind of a cool little, you know, in print written interview with Liam. Good stuff. And we'll put a link on the website for that. So check that one out. Check out the Nikki Hayden article. That's good stuff. And thanks again, like I said, to all the people that did donations. I think that about takes care of our administrative duties. And so the show is fairly long today. I'm going to try to keep the intro fairly short. So why don't we just go ahead and get on with it? Last week's editorial that I did about racing's responsibility to advance technology, which I still wholeheartedly believe in. And responsibility might not necessarily be the right word, but I think that's what it does boil down to. I don't think that total unfettered capitalism of do whatever you want in order to make money, I don't think that's a good thing. I think that you have to be somewhat in some way socially responsible to a point without being, you know, a big anti-capitalist or anything like that. But I also think it's in their best interest. So in any case, I digress. I did the editorial last week. If you haven't heard it, go ahead back to episode 92 and listen to it. But I got quite a bit of email about it, which I thank you very much for, all of you that emailed in. I do appreciate the commentary and stuff like that. I wanted to share a couple of those with you. The first of all, one is from Matthew Thorne, who I was lucky enough to meet at Laguna Seca. And it was great to talk to Matthew and his dad, Terry, in there and everything at Laguna Seca when we were hanging out with Liam at the Baskin-Robbins, which is where Liam had his little meet and greet. And we all sort of showed up there, and I talked to these guys for quite a while. It was good stuff. So Matthew tells me, he says, so listening to your show today, I couldn't agree more with your feelings on the current state of electronics and rider aids. MotoGP is supposed to be the epitome of motorcycle racing and motorcycle technology. We live in the computer age, and electronics are a big part of everything now. I know it was more fun to watch the bikes smoke the tires and slide around, but times change. I actually expect to see that return after a few seasons and then the 800s get closer to their development peaks, which is a really good point, Matthew. And I think that that illustrates the whole MotoGP's technology and continually advancing, continually pushing the envelope. Let's read these rules and find out where we can sort of tweak them to our advantage and you know, maybe even violate the spirit of the rules, but following the letter of the rules. And these are all things that they should do. These are what MotoGP engineers and the Formula One engineers, anybody that's developing a race car or a race motorcycle, they need to find those rules and find the loopholes. So I digress. Sorry about that, Matthew. But Matthew says, you know, he expects to see it return. But he says, I think there's a disconnect in people's minds concerning the amount of power that these bikes can put out and the necessity of traction control to tame them. These bikes are putting out at least 220 horsepower an hour, and they have a very peaky power band. Good luck controlling that bike with no engine management. I think a good case in point would be the Aprilia Cube. By all accounts, it produced a ton of power, and this was back in, when was the Cube? 2003, 2004? But it wasn't usable. That was the beginning of the four-stroke era, and the electronics and traction controls were somewhat primitive. The bike was unrideable, and it seemed to eat riders. I think that Colin Edwards might have been the only rider to ride that bike without suffering a broken bone, although he got barbecued instead. If people want no electronic rider aids, they're going to have to dial down the power as well. I don't think a 250 horsepower motorcycle is really a viable race machine without engine management. I would have more sympathy with the whiners if I saw the whiners, if I saw people who clearly did not deserve or have the talent to be up there winning races simply because of the traction control. But we are not seeing that. The talent is still rising to the top like it always does. Yes, the cream does always come to the top. So I thought that was an excellent email. Matthew continued on a few things. He's talking about the board track racing. He says, I've used the analogy about board track racing to counter argument to myself. Those guys were pure nutters riding around on those death traps, an amazing spectacle, but not worth the cost. And then he says, I think the real instigation for all the Luddite complaints, Luddite, excellent word, thank you, Matthew, Luddite complaints about rider aids is how generally disappointing this season has been with the switch to the 800 and the new tire rules. I think that almost all of the problems of this season stem from the tire rule. Having to pick your tires on Thursday is just plain stupid. It's a huge gamble on the weather as far as track temperature goes, and to put in a restrictive rule like that when the machinery is all new and has not turned a wheel at the majority of the circuits just exacerbates a bad situation. The racing this season has been a bit dull because it's been too much about the tires. And I agree with you on that, Matthew, other than the point that I don't think the races have been all that boring this season. Up until a couple or three races ago, I remember I was saying, you know, this is the best season ever. And I still think that. I can go back and watch those early races, and those were the edge of the seat. That was good stuff. But I do think I agree with you. I know that. I know that I agree with you. And I do think that having such a large change in the rules as far as tires and engine displacement both at the same season was probably a mistake. And I think they're actually seeing that, and we're probably going to see something different going on with next year's tire rules. So thanks again, Matthew, for your email. Next one is from Alan Fleming, longtime friend of MotoGPOD, has his own excellent website. And he says, I hope you don't mind that I'm throwing in my opinion, but hearing you talk about the rules in MotoGP finally directed my myriad thoughts on the subject in a specific direction. At an emotional level, I've always agreed with you. The less the rules in the Premier class, the better. Because you remember one point that I made back in the editorial last week was this is an advantage that MotoGP has, is that the rule book is really thin. But Alan is kind of disagreeing with me somewhat to point. He says, however, I've never been completely comfortable with that opinion, and I think I've finally put some form to that discomfort. Ultimately, I think there are two reasons why some rules are required in MotoGP. First, number one, restraining the 800-pound gorilla. Right up front, I will admit that racing has always been and always will be a game of the haves versus the have-nots. Nonetheless, if the rules sheet really is a blank tablet, then the people with the deepest pockets or more reckless financial planning will win. In our sport, this has manifested itself as the Honda versus Yamaha battles over the past 30 years. Suzuki, Kawasaki, and Ducati all have relatively small R&D departments compared to Honda and Yamaha, and they may always have that odd sort of David versus Goliath victories kind of thing, but those have more to do with mistakes by the big two rather than by successes of the others. Excellent point, Alan. Having some rules in place levels the playing field. Without them, it may well be that Kawasaki or Ducati wouldn't even bother to race in GP, which you can check the grid sheets from as recently as 2001 to see that that's true. And I am well aware that Stoner and Ducati are yanking the rug out from under this argument right now, but I still think this is a perfect storm scenario where the rider, the team, the bike, the tires all came together at the same time. And we talk about that later in this show with Liam. I agree. This is a perfect storm is a good way to put it. It's sort of a confluence of coincidences that has come together, and it's a very good thing for Stoner. He's at the right place on the right bike with the right team at the right time, etc., etc., etc. But I agree with you on this one that you do have to restrain the 800-pound gorilla. But let's go ahead and continue with Alan's email real quick. Number two. Focusing the brilliance of the engineers. You touched on this, but I think it really is important. Race engineers are really brilliant people. They will look at a rule book and see every which way in order to increase power, decrease weight, improve rideability, and make a better motorcycle. With no rules, this means lots of improvements in many different areas of a motorcycle. However, the more restrictive the rules, the more that engineering brilliance is focused in specific areas. Fuel efficiency might improve from year to year no matter what, but to limit the size of the fuel tank and you get massive improvements in a short time, although perhaps you get no improvements in suspension for a while since you're narrowing your problem-solving engineering work. I think that this may increase the rate at which certain types of technology trickles down to production bikes because it's easier to implement improvements when a specific issue is being so thoroughly researched in such a short time. Imagine, from an environmental point of view, what improvements could be made on street bikes if MotoGP bikes had to pass an emissions test. Imagine that. Or imagine the power improvements if the aerodynamic profile was actually standardized to something less efficient than current bikes. That's a great point, Alan. And I did kind of sort of touch on that, and that is something that I sort of maybe was thinking about but didn't actually put into words, that they do need to focus the efforts. By rewriting the rules in certain directions and everything like that, you can force the factories to advance what you want to advance. However, here's the problem. Who determines what you want to advance? In MotoGP, you have several different organizations all working together or fighting one another, depending on the case, to determine the whole rules and all that. They have the FIM, which is by and large a somewhat political type of organization. You have the IRTA, the International Race Teams Association, which is the manufacturers, and it's basically a lobbying group for the manufacturers. And then, of course, you have Dorna, which cares about putting on a good race and let's get, you know, the grids full up, let's get the ratings up and that sort of thing. So you have all these people working together or at odds with one another to create the rules, and having a simple blanket rule like all of a sudden all MotoGP bikes must pass emissions test is going to be somewhat of a difficult thing to pass unless you get enough of these sort of powerful groups wanting it. I think actually that might be a fantastic idea in certain ways. I like to be able to see an engine that's just, you know, unrestricted, open pipes, as loud as hell, burning, you know, who cares how many dinosaurs to get down the track as fast as it can. But if we're going to fit back into our whole social responsibility thing, then that may not necessarily be the best thing. But you do have to direct these rules and energies in certain ways and shapes and forms. And you know, one year it might be fuel efficiency or emissions or all that sort of a thing, you know, environmental sort of concerns. And the next year it might be something along lines of tires. And you might couch this in let's reduce costs by having fewer tires every season or every race weekend. But whenever they have a rule that is designed to reduce costs, it never works to actually reduce cost. It just actually seems to, by and large, increase cost, unless it's a rule that's really hardcore, like the control tire rule in World Superbike. And in that case, I think you get the opposite effect, where, yeah, sure, Pirelli has made improvements to those tires, and Pirelli's learning, but nobody else is. And I think basically you got a case where Pirelli's playing catch up, and the other tire manufacturers, as far as World Superbike is concerned, and if that were the only motorcycle racing series on the planet, the other manufacturers are out of luck, and Pirelli's kind of sitting pretty. So you need balance. It's all about balance. And these are really, really difficult decisions, and I'm glad I'm not the guy making them. But somebody has to, and I do think that the decision makers have these things that they should bear in mind of what do we want as society, what do we want to achieve? Do we want to drive electric motorcycles? You know, maybe not. That's, I don't necessarily want to. But if we decide that we do, then we need to make the best damn electric motorcycle we possibly can, and you need to have racing in order to force that to advance. That, you know, this is where the manufacturers go to test out new ideas, to show off their technologies, to test, to do all sorts of things. And if you can sort of funnel the rules the way you want to go, then I think you are in business. So I had more emails, someone along those lines, no big outright one saying, you know, Bob, you're full of crap. Which, of course, I would always welcome. I like to hear everything from both sides of the fence. You know, obviously, I think that if you're listening to this show, you must not think I'm absolutely completely full of crap. Otherwise, you would have turned it off by now. But if you do, send me an email, bob@motogpod.com. I always appreciate criticism, constructive or otherwise. And also, I always appreciate the a counter viewpoint or anything like that. But thanks again for all those emails. I thought it was real entertaining and hope you did too. One thing that hit the news last week that I neglected to mention in last week's show, unfortunately, is that World Superbike is going to be coming to America in 2008. So after a 3-year absence, they're going to be coming to Miller Motorsports Park. Now, this is a really cool thing, and Gordon Inch, MotoGPOD listener, suggested to me that perhaps I might talk a little bit about Miller Motorsports Park for those of you that are not familiar with it, particularly those of you that reside in countries other than the United States. So Miller Motorsports Park, first of all, let's set a little bit of background kind of thing, is one of these. We're starting to see quite a few of these propping up in Barber, for one. There's one actually going in Oregon. There's the Miller Motorsports Park, and probably a few others, where it's almost a work of passion, you know, one man's dream kind of a thing to build a fantastic road course or something along those lines. And Miller Motorsports Park is definitely like that. It's in Tooele, Utah, so it's not exactly at the population center of the United States, but it is fairly close to Salt Lake City. It's about a half hour out of Salt Lake City. It's a large population center there, and it's got both downside and upside to being situated where it's at. One thing on the good side is that, you know, you have this beautiful racetrack and it's situated away far enough out in the boondocks that it's not too likely to run into a lot of the problems that racetracks run into when they're close to cities. But on the downside, like I said, it's pretty much out somewhat in the middle of nowhere. Now, Salt Lake City, you know, is a nice enough town and all that sort of thing, but it's not exactly the biggest tourist draw in the United States for international tourism. So this is somewhat of a drawback. But I think that having World Superbike there is going to be a big help. Now, talking about Miller Motorsports Park, the place is just fantastic. Of course, I'm going to put a link to the website in the show notes and everything, so you'll see it at MotoGPOD.com. You can find it, but it's MillerMotorsportsPark.com. You can't go wrong with that. The road course there that they've designed is 4.5 miles long. It's 40 to 50 feet wide, 24-turn layout, and it has a wide variety of cornering speeds from 50 miles an hour to well over 100 miles an hour. Fastest cars and motorcycles will approach 200 miles per hour on the track's 50-foot-wide, 3,500-foot main straightaway. It has four possible configurations, a 2.25-mile east course. It's a highly technical challenge suited to lower-powered, better-handling cars and motorcycles, while the 2.2-mile west course is fitted for higher-power, larger cars and motorcycles. The east course has as many as 7 major overtaking areas and 14 corners, including the 3-turn S's, and the feature corner on the east course is the final turn, which is a 50-foot-wide, 9-degree banked sweeper that leads onto the main straight. It's designed to create last-minute overtaking challenges before the race to the finish line. The west course is notable for a sequence of 3 very fast, 100-mile-an-hour-plus corners, which lead to the heaviest braking and slowest corner of the track, which is number W5. The 45-foot-wide entrance encourages overtaking. Rest of the west course features several multiple radius and complex corners designed to challenge driver skills and rider skills, of course. The Miller Motorsports Park longest configuration, which is the full course, it has a character completely different from either of the two shorter layouts. And in this 4.5-mile configuration, speeds will be extremely high, both at the end of the long main straight and through the daunting sequence of turns that comprise the first elements of the east side of the course, where cornering speeds will approach 150 miles an hour. Then there's a fourth configuration, which is the roughly 3-mile outer course, 3.06-mile outer course. And this eliminates the entire infield section, and it promises to be one of the fastest track layouts in North America. Now, while the track is basically flat, it's in, you know, Utah, and although you do have the Rocky Mountains very nearby, but large areas of Utah are quite flat, Miller Motorsports Park designers did add quite a few elevation changes, significant elevation changes, to give it character and everything. And the views are spectacular. You can just see these mountains in the distance and everything. I mean, it's a beautiful place. It's really, really a neat place with fantastic facilities. They've got 27 Formula One style garages. They've got a large visitors complex that is, it's almost like a country club. There's membership and everything here at Miller Motorsports Park. So you have a membership fee and you go in and get access to races and track days and all that sort of thing when you do that. And that's starting to become somewhat common with these road courses that are popping up over America, where, because they're a work of passion rather than a work of profitability. You know, if an individual or an organization or a town or whatever wants to just build a racetrack for a profitable sort of spectator event, they're going to build a super oval in the United States. But when somebody wants to have road courses, it's got to be a labor of love. And in order to sort of pay for this labor of love, because you can't do it all on your own dime, this is one of the things to do about it. It's sort of a country club, which is, somewhat like Almería in Spain and all those sort of places. So it's really, really great that World Superbike is coming to America again. This is yet another example of how motorcycle road racing is reaching a new sort of level in America. You know, we're attracting international attention, which is good, and plus the fact that the international series are coming to the United States, 2 dates for MotoGP in 2008 and World Superbikes in 2008. This is only a good thing. It's going to strengthen the sport. It's going to encourage viewership, encourage participation. People see that, and maybe they'll go try a track day and that sort of thing. And motorcycles is one area where a lot of people do race. I think even somewhat almost more so than cars in some respects. You talk to motorcyclists, and it seems like so many of them have done at least a track day. You know, maybe they're not amateur racers, but they've been on the track. Whereas, you know, a lot of guys that have fairly sporty little cars have never done anything other than, you know, cruising the boulevard and maybe the occasional illegal street drag race and that sort of thing. So, all of this is just, it's going to expand our sport in America. It's going to expand motorcycling in America. And it's good for these places like Miller and Barber and Laguna Seca and even Indy, when they have, the 2008 MotoGP series there and all of that. It's just a good thing. So I'm really looking forward to that. I will definitely be going to Miller Motorsports Park in 2008 for the World Superbike Date. They're going to be there with the AMA. Now, one interesting thing, and I picked this one up off of, roadracingworld.com. So I'm going to give them full credit and I will put a link to the story on the website as well. And only read a small quote is that they're going to be using different configurations. World Superbike is going to use that outer track that we talked about, the three odd mile outer track, whereas AMA is going to be using the main track, the 4.5 mile main track. Word on the street is that World Superbike does not want direct lap time comparison with the AMA because they're a little concerned that, of how things are going to turn out as far as that. I'm actually really, really curious of how things would turn out with that. Let's see what Matt Mladen and Ben Spies' lap times do compared to the top tier of World Superbike, which won't be James Toseland next year, but it'll be guys along those lines, you know. And the thing there is not rider skill so much, although that's going to be part of it, but the tires. You got a control tire in World Superbike. You don't have a control tire in AMA. How is that going to shape things up as far as a lap time? But unfortunately, we're not going to get to see it. And I think that the Flamini brothers that are running World Superbike know that, and that's why they insisted on the two separate courses. And also, World Superbike will be able to have their own advertising signage and all that along that inner course, which is basically you can keep it out of the camera's view. So it'd almost be like when you're watching AMA races there in 2008 on television and you're watching the World Superbike races there, that you won't even barely notice that they're at the same facility other than those fantastic mountain panoramas that you're going to be seeing in the background. So this is a real good thing. I'm going to encourage you to take a look at the website, MillerMotorsportsPark.com, and we're going to see if we can get a little more information going on about it. And I hope that this helps any of our international listeners that are kind of thinking maybe they should come out for 2008. I encourage you to come out. Come to Salt Lake City. It's a it's a different sort of a place. You're not in sort of the traditional let's go to Disneyland side of America, but it's beautiful. And if you're into sort of the natural beauty at all, you could take a little road trip and drive around at probably fairly high speeds for what you're maybe used to, and maybe take a trip to something like the Grand Tetons or Monument Valley or all those sorts of things and see just comes the scenic wonder of the Western United States, which is fantastic stuff. One last thing that I had in my notes to actually mention in this segment, and then I totally overlooked, is the press release from Miller Motorsports Park, where they're announcing the FIM Superbike World Championship event for 2008 from Tooele Valley, which, by the way, Tooele is spelled Thule, T-O-O-E-L-E, and that's because it's out in the Thules. But there's a quote from Maurizio Flamini, president of the FG Sport Group that has organized the FIM Superbike World Championship. And he says that at Miller Motorsports, the ideal venue for the series return to the North American market, blah, blah, blah. We consider it a very interesting circuit. And here's the part, with top facilities compared with the American standard. So that's a bit of a left-handed compliment. I think it's great that he's paying that to Miller Motorsports Park. But on the other hand, he's basically saying that the rest of the road courses in America are crap. And he might have a point, but it's not something that he necessarily needs to say in print. So I wanted to get that in. Like I said, I sort of forgot to mention it during my main blurb. And there we go. MotoGP travels to a circuit this weekend that they haven't been to since 1993, and that's the Misano Circuit. This is officially called the Grand Prix of San Marino. But I believe that the Misano Circuit's actually truly in Italy. San Marino is one of those tiny little republics that you run across now, and then it's actually the oldest republic in the world, and it's only 1/10 the size of New York City, surrounded by Italy. nestled in the rolling hills of Rimini. Actually not nestled. It's right on the coast. Misano is going to be a good race. They've done a lot of renovations to the circuit. There's a lot of history at the circuit. It first started in 1969. They hosted 10 MotoGP events previously up till 1993. Unfortunately, one of the things that Misano is mostly remembered for is that in 1993, that's where Wayne Rainey had a catastrophic crash, and the depth of the gravel was too deep, and it caused the motorcycle to flip and tumble more. And it basically the motorcycle hit him. So he had a crash and was hit by his own motorcycle and just paralyzed him for life. So Wayne Rainey is in a wheelchair due to that. But, that's racing. I mean, what are you going to say? And Wayne Rainey has sort of gone on to accept that. Kenny Roberts has said that he won't be at the race for a variety of reasons. One, it's on Labor Day weekend, and he kind of wants to spend time with his family and all of the thing. But the other thing is somewhat to a point bad memories. He did point out that there's a fine dust that tends to settle on the track, a white powdery dust, and that this affects grip. And he said that one year he had them hose off the track with fire hoses, and this track lap times went down considerably and improved grip all around and all this sort of thing. So this might have something to do with some of those problems of why Wayne Rainey crashed that year. But in any event, I think it is going to be a super good race. The Misano circuit, they've done a whole lot of improvements and everything. Starting in 2006, they lengthened the track. It's now 4,180 meters, which is about 2.6 miles. And most significantly, it's now a clockwise circuit instead of counterclockwise. So this is going to negate anybody's experience with this track. Loris Capirossi has raced here before. He had his very first podium appearance in the Grand Prix way back when in 1990. At the age of only 17, he took third place. And, but that was racing counterclockwise. Colin Edwards, Christopher Mullen, quite a few of the other riders, I think, have all raced at Misano in one way or the other, but none of them have raced in the new form of the clockwise circuit, except Ant West. Now, will this give Ant West a little bit of an advantage? Possibly. I'm not 100% sure. The riders do get an extra hour of practice time, and perhaps more significantly, they get additional tires. They get two more rear tires and one more front tire for testing and whatnot, so that's kind of cool. Get a few more tires to go out there and check it out. The circuit, like I said, it's 4,180 meters, 2.6 miles. It's a fantastic circuit with 16 corners. You've got 6 lefts and 10 rights. It might be a little bit narrow. One of the points that Matthew Thorne made in his excellent email, which we talked about earlier in the show, is he says, "I can't really say that I'm looking forward to the Misano round. That track sucks. I watched the World Superbike races there earlier in the year, and the racing wasn't very good. The track is too narrow and too tight. Passing seems very limited, and with the current state of MotoGP, it might be an uninspiring race, but I hope to be proven wrong." I also hope that you're wrong on that one too, Matthew, but we will have to see. We don't have a whole lot of data going on about Misano for MotoGP other than that, because everything is so new, and I have to say that I don't recall watching that World Superbike race. That might have been one of the ones that I missed this year for a variety of reasons. But in any event, it does have a lot of history behind it, and history is always good. And they've done a whole lot of improvements, and improvements are always good too. So I think that if nothing else, we're in for an interesting weekend. Whether or not it's the greatest race that we've seen this year or not, I don't know. Stoner's got a 60-point lead going into this weekend. That's very, very significant. And however, this is another little interesting tidbit that I picked up on MotoGP.com, is that a 60-point lead, the only rider who has failed to go on and win the world title, the only rider who's failed to go on and win the world title after having such a lead is Mick Doohan, who had a lead of 65 points with 5 races of the year remaining, but he did not win the title after he suffered serious injuries, which resulted in him missing several races. And obviously we don't want Casey Stoner to be injured in any way, shape, or form, because I don't want anybody to be injured. But it's pointing out, like Liam says, you can't count your chickens until they're hatched. So while Stoner has a significant lead, doesn't necessarily mean he's got it in the bag yet. It's not a mathematical certainty. So I'm actually looking forward to it. It's going to be on Speed TV here in the United States. Don't forget, we're done with CBS and Fox for the rest of the year. Everything's going to be on Speed. It's on at 1 p.m. Pacific time, which is, what, 4 p.m. Eastern time on Speed TV on Sunday. This is Labor Day weekend. Good stuff. We also have AMA Super Mladen, and that's going to be happening at Road Atlanta this weekend. So that's going to be another cool thing going on this weekend on Speed TV here in the United States. For those of you in Europe and watching Eurosport or elsewhere in the world, Japan, Australia, wherever you're at, consult your local listings. But I will be watching the race live. So Sunday morning, we did Brno. We had the MotoGP OD chat room combined with the Ride On 2, same chat room and stuff. There's a lot of people in there. It was kind of fun. I'll be watching the race live. Should be on at 5 a.m., I do believe. That's when I'm going to be getting up. And I will come in and join us. Go to MotoGP OD. On the left side, there's a chat room link. And hit that chat room link. It sort of starts this little flash thing right there in your browser. You don't have to install any software or anything like that. And you just sort of pick a username. Don't pick Bob, because that's me. And then you can, we'll talk about the race or whatever. Most of the time I'm going to be watching the race, but I will have that chat room sort of thing running on the side. And it might be limited to a, wow, did you see that? Or that sort of a thing. But it was fun. It was good times last time. And Jules Cisek should probably be there unless he's so busy that he can't watch the race. But Jules is generally going to be up, I'm thinking, at 5 a.m. And plus, a lot of our listeners that are elsewhere in the world and seeing the race at a slightly more reasonable hour will definitely be there. So it'll be good times. Check it out. Chat room on MotoGP OD to watch the races live if you happen to have a MotoGP.com subscription, or maybe you're watching on Eurosport or somewhere or whatever it is that broadcasts it live. Well, we got Liam on the phone today. Liam's in Italy. How are you doing today, Liam?
Hey, how's it going, everybody in MotoGP land? I'm doing good, Bob. I'm sitting, I guess, 100 meters from the beach in Rimini, which is a little beachside area in Misano. The town itself that I'm in is Cattolica, no H. So Cattolica, which is right next to Riccione, and it's an awesome little beach town. I guess a lot of tourists from Italy come here. The beach is covered with umbrellas and stands, and just really, really nice. Lots of tourists walking around, but all Italians. And, you know, fun little seaside town. More built up than what you'd find in the seaside towns in L.A. But I saw the mountain. Someone pointed at it and said, oh, Rossi Valentino was born just over that mountain. He's about 5 kilometers away, which is, what, 3.1 miles. So, yeah, a lot of neat things around here.
That's cool. How far are you from the track where you're at right now?
Maybe about 15 minutes or
cool.
less.
And how's
really
the weather?
Not that far at all.
Yeah.
Oh, it's hot.
Hot?
The weather is hot. I mean, sweating dogs and cats hot.
Wow. So you think it's going to be hot enough to affect the riding conditions and the tires and all that?
Yeah, if the weather stays the same, then everybody has to choose tomorrow. They have to choose hot stuff and hope that the manufacturers brought enough allocation of hot stuff to be able to supply everybody with the same stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole tire rule seems to be coming under fire lately in the news. People are saying it's kind of...
Yeah, a bunch of crybabies.
said the team that's benefiting quite well from the tire rule.
Not really. I mean, look, we're still fairly at the bottom of the team standings. I don't think we've achieved our potential. We're definitely better than last year, but then we have a couple of races where it seems like we haven't really changed position from last year, despite all the speeds getting higher.
Yeah, I think, wouldn't you say
that? Yeah, we'll touch on the tire subject later tonight. That's something I wouldn't mind getting into.
Yeah, we will. Let's talk about it. Tires are always one of my favorite subjects. But wouldn't you say that some of the issues that you've been seeing lately are as much due to injury as anything else?
Yeah, I mean, my riders have been knocked up and dinged a little bit, and everything's gotten so close now. I mean, most factors hit solid, you know, home runs, maybe not a grand slam like Ducati's lining up, but the bikes are so much closer than they ever were. You look at how far Suzuki and Kawasaki have come, are they equal or better than Honda? I mean, this is something that was unheard of 2 years ago, or last year, or, you know, when the 990s first hit. It's everybody's so close, and you only need one qualifying to understand that. When there was such a bigger gap, you know, when the top five might be covered by a second, now we've got up to 12 within a second or more. It's just unbelievable how tight everything's gotten.
Yeah, I agree. Even though, and this has been covered in articles too, that the racing itself, though, is tending to stretch out a little bit. We're seeing bigger gaps between first and second on average and things like that.
Is a rider that puts the hammer down and pushes it. Let me see how to say this nicely. The last race, Stoner took off, and John Hopkins was following him initially. They were both running low 58s, which was a pretty incredible time. And John said he was likely to lose it at every corner. He was worried about throwing it away. And after a couple of laps, he tried to stay with him. He just said, oh, I can't do it. And he quotes himself as saying he quit. He didn't give up, but he knew he wasn't going to get Stoner. He had to back off. I mean, the truth of the matter is, if it was all tires, Kawasaki, Suzuki, Ducati, they all use the same tires. So we'd be seeing other riders get up there and challenge more. So I think you can't take anything away from Casey this year, despite everybody pointing at the tires and saying, well, if Valentino's finishing 30 seconds behind, then obviously something's wrong. This is an evolutionary year for the bikes, and different riders are able to push harder this year. And Casey's taken an evolutionary step, and he's on a level that no one else is touching. Kaporowski's certainly not coming close, despite having access to a factory machine and having the same tires to choose from, and having a crew that's been with him 5 years. You know, the fact that the new guy is coming in and kicking butt is quite amazing, and it lets you know that the kid is riding with a lot of balls and a lot of confidence, and he knows what he's doing.
Right, I agree. We've talked about this one before, and it is. It's not just the tires. It's not just the bike. It's the whole package. There's a lot of things that are working into this. And Casey Stoner's in the catbird seat as far as being able to take advantage of it and being able to reap the benefits of this sort of fortunate confluence of events or whatever you want to call it. And you know, it's classic right place, right time, right guy sort of a situation.
Yeah, I heard something that if he was on a Honda, he wouldn't win a race this year, or if he was on any other bike, he wouldn't be winning races this year.
I don't know about that. But I heard that too.
Yeah, I think after he changed out of the Honda, I think his marriage really did him a lot of good. I think the confidence of being on a factory team, no matter which one it was, that has really done wonders for him. Because as a privateer for so many years and watching his family struggle with the dream, and I mean, that whole group, him and his family, have really put themselves out there more than most other riders in the hopes of getting a factory ride and pushing to be in a position to get a factory ride. And when he did, you know, everything clicked. And I think it would have been a lot of fun to see him on a Honda challenging Rossi on a Yamaha. If they were both on Yamahas, everything being equal, I think they'd still have a hell of a season. And I don't know who'd come out on top.
Yeah, I tend to be of the opinion, for the most part, that on absolute equal machinery, I think Rossi could probably still outride him. But, again, it's a package deal. There's so much going on. And Stoner in the 250s, you know, it's been with the 800 being somewhat similar to the 250s, maybe that's partially why. It's been, you know, it's been shorter time since Stoner was on a 250 compared to Rossi. And who knows? You know, those sorts of things.
I'd like to point out how fast the 250s have gotten since Rossi was on one. I mean, you look at the last year Rossi was on a 250. That was 99. And tires haven't made a gigantic leap, but the times sure have. When you look at the 250 time, I thought it was absolutely stunning that Lorenzo qualified with a 250 faster than Rossi's 500 qualifying time earlier this year. I think it was Catalunya. That blew me away.
Yeah, it is kind of amazing, especially for a bike technology, the two-stroke, the 250 and everything, that was basically supposed to be at the end of its sort of development. You know, the machine has been perfected kind of a thing. And, yeah.
Somewhat. The 500s, I think, were at the end of their development cycles. But the 250s, Aprilia and KTM have definitely taken a step forward this year. Aprilia continues to push development. Honda has stopped. I think basically they're running roughly the same what they were running last year. So Dovizioso is having a hell of a year on a bike that hasn't taken a step forward. Honda's really not putting their full weight behind the 250, to say the least.
Now, you said that the tires in 250, you don't think they've changed that much. Is that what you don't think you're seeing a lot of advances going on since, like, 99 in tires?
Well, I don't really think so. I mean, Dunlop's been good in 250 for a lot of years, and it seems to work well with every bike in 250. So there really doesn't seem to be any reason for them to push harder in 250. They've got that championship locked. It's the same with Pirelli. And this is going to lead into something I wanted to talk about, because I spoke with some different people in the tire business. We'll put it that way, because I don't want to point anybody out or name manufacturers. But just speaking about Pirelli and World Superbike, I've been seeing a lot on the internet, and people have been asking me a lot, well, a control tire is a great idea. Look how competitive Superbike's gotten. Look how many different people are challenging for race wins. It really proves that now it's just the rider and the bike, and the tires aren't really a consideration. And I don't think anybody's talking about it or realizing that the tires don't necessarily work for each brand of bike depending on the circuit. And the clearest example I can put on that is, hey, there are some circuits where the Honda's not doing well, and it could be because the Honda doesn't work with the tires. There are some circuits where the Ducati is nowhere, because it doesn't work well at that circuit with the tires. If a tire manufacturer, doesn't work with each individual motorcycle brand, you're kind of at the mercy of Pirelli and how it works with your bike at that circuit, because each circuit is so radically different. You can't take the same set of tires and expect to be the best if you have the best bike. It has to do with power delivery. It has to do with how the bike uses the tires and how the rider uses tires. It's something I don't think anybody's really pointing out. Right now, the Honda is working well, but some races, the Yamaha works better. You know, and that's why the Yamahas are up front. Other races, the Ducati works better, and Troy mops everybody up. So you've got a lot of talented riders there, and it's kind of a crapshoot. Which tire is going to benefit which manufacturer the most at this circuit?
Yeah, to a point. And now,
so not how to do you, a point. I mean, I wouldn't take the same Dunlop 208s or 209s and put them on every single bike and expect them to do well at Laguna, and then take those same bikes and expect it to be the exact same thing at Pikes Peak.
Right.
And this is not to say that Pirelli doesn't try to do some type of development with all the manufacturers to homogenize a tire that works for everybody. It's not really possible. And in a certain way, even though it brings racing more competitiveness in that you've got more guys challenging for wins, different guys challenging for wins, different circuits, it kind of takes away from the purity of balls out racing, where everybody puts everything into this bike winning the race and this rider winning the race, the way it is in GP. Because we know for sure, Michelin and Bridgestone make the tires for that bike and that rider. Elias has a different style. They make him something different. Pedrosa has a definitively different style. He uses tires unlike anybody else. You know he has different tires just for him. And that's, you know, as long as the tire manufacturer can put resources towards developing tires for the rider and the bike, you're going to see the times and you're going to see real evolution. If a control tire came into MotoGP, I really think it'd be a punch in the gut. It would kind of take the wind out of my sails, that's for sure.
Yeah, I agree. And that, you know, that's something that Jules and I talked about a little bit last week and everything. I think actually the control tire is the rule in World Superbike is working better than I anticipated it would. I mean, World Superbike's having a really good season this year of fun racing to watch, and maybe, you know, part of that is because of the control tire, you know, they've had for a few years, but for whatever reason, but I definitely don't want to see it in MotoGP. No, I really don't.
Okay.
I've gotten a lot of email that agreeing with the same thing. I don't think anybody wants a control tire in MotoGP.
Yeah, and another thing I want to touch on is Rossi possibly switching to Bridgestone. had a lot of teams trying to jump ship from Michelin to jump to Bridgestone. I would say Bridgestone is already on the limit as far as how many people they can supply, just from a reality standpoint, what I see and what I know and speaking with people in their organization. Plus, it really kind of feels like somebody would have given up. Say, oh, okay, Bridgestone's having a great year. I want to switch to them. I mean, the whole point of the switch to Yamaha was to find a new challenge, a new motivation. Now that Michelin is not the top tire, that should be a renewed point as far as a renewed motivation. Like, oh, okay, now I have something to do. I've developed this bike as best I can. Now let's develop tires as best that we can. So, personally, I hope that certain companies stay with Michelin, because it's only going to benefit the series and the racing if Michelin can raise their level to where Bridgestone's at this year, in general. Then we're going to have a hell of a bunch of good racing next year.
Yeah, I agree. And I'd like to see Dunlop continue as well, and hopefully, you know, put a, you know, as much effort as they can into improving. You know, just the more the merrier. So on the whole Rossi thing, you're basically saying, right, that Rossi is, I don't know how to put this one nicely where you said earlier, but
you want to be tactful. You want to say that he reaped the benefits of the last 5 years, and maybe this is a bad year.
Right, and that now he's just jumping ship at the first sign of disaster thing?
He's never said that he's going to go to Bridgestone. He has been a little critical of Michelin, maybe more than a little, but there's a lot of frustration involved in racing motorcycles, because it's people that are passionate about winning only care about winning. Anything less is a failure. I know I'm going to come off sounding kind of like a jerk, but we podiumed this year in Mugello, and we had a fourth place earlier. You know, granted, that the fourth place was a Bridgestone weekend, so I don't really count that too much. But we had a third place in Mugello, and now anything less than that, to me, is not so nice. I'm not going to say it's a failure, because I know each weekend's different, and I know the level of our material. I know if another Bridgestone team might have something different than what we've got, or, you know, I know there are different circumstances, lots of different circumstances at each race. Each weekend is different. But I got to be honest, sometimes I feel that we don't quite knock it out of the park.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, you raised the bar of your expectations by getting that podium.
Yeah, and, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, sure, you guys know what you can do. And so there must be, you know, what's happening here, why we're not doing that. You know, there must be some reason. Yeah,
well, you know, it's intrinsic in my psyche as far as what I want to do. I want to come out here and be as successful as I can racing motorcycles. Like, give my ability, give my talents and my hard work to the team so that we can do as best as we can do. And yeah, when I see what we're capable of, that's all I want. And when we don't do that, I think, okay, we got to come back the next time. I'm not frustrated with my team or with my riders, not angry or upset, but it really makes me want to do better for the next race.
Sure. And a little bit of healthy disappointment kind of a thing. I mean, if you were, you know, if you were totally happy with that position, then you might be content to stay there.
Yeah, we might say constructive frustration.
There you go. I think that's a good way to put it. Hey, I got one quick thing to go back to the tires thing with Rossi going to Bridgestone, the possibility. And you said that Bridgestone probably can't support more riders. That's an excellent point that I've seen come up a lot, and I'm sure it's true. So do you think that Bridgestone, if this whole thing comes to pass, where we see Rossi wants to go to Bridgestone, do you think Bridgestone is going to dump a different team in order to be able to support the Yamaha Lorenzo team?
It's possible, but Bridgestone has a really good loyalty going on with its three factory teams. I could possibly see a satellite team being dropped by Bridgestone. Well, not really dropped, just they're unable to supply it.
Right.
Fortunately, the satellite teams, my team, we benefit because they develop tires with the factory Ducati. So, you know, what's left for us, basically what's made for the factory Ducati, and since our bikes are the same, it works out great.
Sure, yeah.
When
I
look at
a
team like Gresini, Gresini is not the factory Honda. So they're trying to develop tires not only for a satellite bike, which maybe is at a lower spec, and probably will be considerably lower spec next year if what I'm hearing is going to be true, that the factory Honda is going to be head and shoulders above the satellite bikes. So Bridgestone is developing bikes, developing tires for a satellite bike, and secondly, they're developing for riders with peculiar riding traits. You know, their style is not the norm. So they're putting a lot of energy into helping the Gresini team, and yet I think if they said, well, we could pick up another factory, and, you know, what should we do with Gresini?
Right.
That would be the question more than mine. Then again, maybe Gresini pays more than we do for the tires, so I don't know.
yeah, you got a lot of factors into the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of factors, and money is probably the biggest one, and then second is the relationship between the two groups, and thirdly, how is it going to benefit Bridgestone as far as producing tires? Because eventually this all trickles down to the street.
Right, I agree, and that's always been one of my points, and yes, I've said it again and again, and listeners are probably getting tired of hearing me say it about how great tires are nowadays because of what we see in racing.
Oh my God, it's unbelievable. I couldn't have ever pushed tires like this 10 years ago. I'd be either on my ass or thrown over the handlebars every time.
you're talking regular old street tires that you buy for your motorcycle riding on the street.
Yeah, 10 years ago, if I tried to do some of the things that I've done just this past summer, my God.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree.
Bikes have gone through such a tremendous evolution. You look at a 600 today and a 600 10 years ago. Yowza.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of street bikes.
Yeah, and you managed to get quite a bit of riding in during your California vacation there after Laguna, didn't you? Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah. I need to make an extra special thank you to John Canton and Ducati North America. They are the United States division of Ducati, and they handled everything in North America. And they were kind enough to loan me, initially, a Paul Smart, which is a Sport 1000S. They loaned me a red one with a twin shock in the rear, and it's the bike I requested, actually, even though I thought, you know, I should get myself some kind of super sport or, you know, something a little bit more aggressive. I thought, oh, I really like the style of that bike. And me, the look is so evocative and so red.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a cool bike. You know, not full on retro, but definitely Ducati roots-y. It's cool.
Yeah, and I mean, it pulls a lot of the retro vibe with the bubble fairing and the nose. And then you look at some of the angles through the tank and the fact that the bottom of the bubble nose is also angled. It's a really, really beautiful bike. I mean, I caught myself just sitting down staring at it numerous times. It's the kind of bike that I like to look at. I do have a couple of criticisms of it that I hope will be worked out, but I'm not the target audience for that bike. In certain ways, it's narrow-waisted, where you know, at the front of the seat where you want to put your legs down, but the tail section is a little wider than I'm used to. The tank and fairing did make the bike a little bit wider than I'm used to. And the suspension is set up for street riding, not for racing. So I wanted to horse around and really, really get into it and start dragging things. And the combination, it has really good front brakes, steel braided lines, black coated. You hit the brakes and that front end just dives down. And if you have a couple of quick corners in succession, the bike gets a little bit unsettled. It prefers high speed sweepers. Up around 90, it starts to float really gracefully, kind of like I guess if you were hustling around in an old muscle car, it doesn't like quick transition changes back and forth, left and right. But when you're really moving along, then, you know, the suspension, you just kind of feel yourself floating along. And that's the correlation I'm going to make. kind of like a muscle car from the 70s.
That's a good one.
About
the suspension, is this something that that you just weren't kind of able to dial out of the suspension? When you say the suspension is set up for street riding, is it limitation of the suspension that you've got?
It's set up more for the street, more for cruising around, Sunday rides.
Right, which I think makes sense. That is the target market.
It's for a slightly older demographic than I am.
Right, and you just weren't able to adjust the suspension to your liking. I mean, it would take more major work to get the suspension sporty enough for you.
Yeah, I'd need to have it sprung and valved for me. Mm-hmm. There again, I have a peculiar taste. I really like a hard front end, which is why I have a really difficult time riding supermotos that are for the street. Because no matter how much I fiddle with everything, I just find front ends too soft on supermoto bikes. And when I get aggressive on the brake, the back end just comes up. So I prefer to have a hard front end to be able to get on the brake as hard and as late as possible and then, you know, screw the gas on and see what happens. I like a firmer front end. I don't like a lot of pitch and yaw back and forth. I don't like bikes that pogo and seesaw off the front and the rear suspension. I like something that works equally as a package. And it, you know, it has to be set up for the type of speeds you like to do also. Something that works at low speeds is not going to work as well at high speeds.
Right. Yep. Totally
so anyway, I was cruising around. I put about almost 800 miles on it in under a week. I love that, the look. It was just gorgeous. I mean, I caught myself cleaning it every morning, making sure there were no fingerprints on it, because everybody had to finger it.
Of course.
You know, run their hand across the tank. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff that, as a biker, it drives me insane. It's my bike. I don't want anybody touching it. That's it. You know, if you're going to sit on it, you put your ass in the seat, your hand on the handlebars, and that's it. You don't need to ever touch the paint on a motorcycle unless you're cleaning it. And it should always be shiny. Or clean. You know, if you take a flat black bike, it should be clean. No greasy fingerprints.
Yeah. I tend to agree. I like a clean motorcycle.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there. I was down in the Mission District of San Francisco, and I had just moved the bike at the suggestion of a friend. He said, hey, you should move your bike so you can keep an eye on it. You know, plenty of parking around here. I said, okay, no problem. And I moved the bike. I pulled in directly in front of a cafe that I was finishing up at, an internet cafe, and I had about a bike length on either side, maybe more on one side than the other. And I thought, all right, it's about as safe as you can get besides parking in a garage. And as I'm sitting there drinking my coffee, it was the first time I had a chai latte, I think it was a pretty fancy sweet drink.
Uh-huh.
I'm sitting there watching, and this older gentleman comes walking across the street, passes the bike, gets in his truck, and throws it in reverse. And I'm thinking, if I should make a whistle or a hoot or a yell and let him know, hey, there's a bike behind you? But I figured, yeah, the guy's got a bike length in front of him, a bike length behind him. He's in a little Toyota truck, and he walked past it. There's no way he could have missed it. So he throws it in reverse, and the next thing I hear is that it kind of sounds like a remote control car in reverse sound, or a Honda Civic when it's going in reverse, kind of fast, just like, whang. The guy stomps on the gas, punches into the bike, breaks the foot peg, and the bike then kind of stands up on its kickstand because it got knocked over on the kickstand side. So it stands up, pivots, which meant the wheel came off the ground, and it lifted up and then fell over onto its side.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so my heart sank because I'm sitting there with my coffee, and I see the bike leap up in the air, and I'm just thinking, oh, my God. And I just so happened to be talking on the phone with somebody at the time, and a stream of X's came out of my mouth that would have made a military guy, Bob. I just, something clicked, you know, my magic swearing abilities, and it was, I jump out in the street, and the guy has already thrown it into first and is out on the Mission Boulevard. So I run out, slap the side of his car, I get to his door, and I'm yelling, just kicking up the hugest ruckus I can, short of kicking in the door, and he stares at me like, oh, shit, somebody got me. So he starts screaming at me that I didn't see it. I'm like, how the, you know, do you not see it? And we're having this exchange. Then he says that, well, I parked in his space, so I was illegal. And then I said, well, you're trying to flee the scene of an accident, so that's a felony. That's called hit and run. And it kept getting bigger and bigger until I photographed with my phone. I photographed his license plate and told him he could do whatever he wanted after that. And that's when things kind of calmed down. And beautifully enough, on that particular motorcycle, the passenger pegs fit where the rider pegs go. So I rode over to a buddy's house. I was just a few minutes away, got my tools, and put the passenger peg where it belonged, so I was able to put the foot peg again. And the next day I rode about, I don't know, 50, 55 miles down to where Ducati North America is located in Cupertino. And I wanted to bring the bike to them because, one, it was damaged. Two, I gave them all the insurance information. And three, it was my chance to finally get a hold of a 999S, which is a magnificent bike. I have a nickname for it. For the street and my type of riding, it's a really simple nickname. I call it God Bike because after getting off the 1000F, I got on this felt 999. Handlebar seemed higher. Feet was more comfortable. I mean, it was a pleasure to ride, even in a straight line. Then I had Olean suspension front and rear, and it was set up originally by, I'm blanking out on the guy's name. He's a race tuner that's out of Texas with a motorcycle shop, a Ducati store. Oh. And he sets them up aggressively for aggressive riding. And it looks like the thing came straight off the racetrack. It was perfect for me. Everything about the bike was perfect. I could get on the gas. I could spin the rear wheel. I was hanging off using a lot of body English because, to be honest, the steering damper, being what it is, and the angle of the front end, the geometry, at first and second gear low speeds, it really is truck-like. You got to use a lot of force to get the handlebars to go left and right. But as soon as you're moving at 20 miles an hour, and you just put an ass cheek off the seat, the bike just falls right into place. And then you can deviate from your line based on your body English. Then when you go up to nuclear speeds, north of 100, then the bike becomes God Bike. I had this crazy dream that I was riding the bike at high speed and just rolling along. I had a clear open road in front of me, a big hill, a giant left-hander, and I thought, why not? So I put the pedal to the metal in my dream, screwed it on, was blasting, me on the deck, or within inches. I'm thinking, man, this is the sweetest thing, because as soon as I was cranked over to where I was comfortable and making a corner, it seemed like the suspension was, you know, it was unbelievable. Every bump, ripple, rain groove, everything that I came across was just kind of soaked up, and I could feel the bike shudder but not twitch, and the chassis never got upset at all. And as I'm rolling up and coming out of the corner thinking I should ease off a little bit, in my dream, I look down and I'm thinking, wow, we're just a tad off of $150. This is amazing. This is the kind of bike that if not for some of the front end looks, I could totally, totally roll one of those in my real life.
It's really cool that you're getting the opportunity to do this. You know, I mean, you're sort of famous enough, Moto Liam and all of that, that you know, you're getting free bikes from Ducati to borrow. I mean, that's awesome. So
yeah, completely different from how things were a year or 2 years ago. I think they respect a lot the job that I'm doing, and they know the circumstances of my work situation, and that I don't get the chance to really get on a bike. And I really used this past trip to reconnect with why I love motorcycling, because after 2 years being without a full-size street bike and being able to hammer it all the time, I kind of forgotten portions of why I loved it.
Oh yeah.
And I'll back up and give a little bit of history. I would generally put between 20 and 30,000 miles on a year after year. I've put nearly 100,000 miles on fuels.
Really? I didn't know that.
Tube frame Buells. Yeah. So I know what it's like to ride a bike with a heavy flywheel that takes a ton of body English to transition left to right. I know what rotating mass is. And I know really strange, funky bikes. I didn't just ride rigid choppers my whole life or Honda Monkeys. I've got quite a good experience with street bikes, and I love kicking ass during commuting. Now, this is not to say that when you're stuck in traffic doing 25 or 45, I'm the guy that goes lane splitting at 100. I don't blast through traffic like that. But there's a different mindset that successful commuters have. And I say this because I commuted in L.A. on motorcycles. I know all about the 405 and just getting through traffic. And then I moved up to the Bay Area where freeway speeds are 85. It's the norm when traffic's flowing. And when it gets thick, they're still moving 85 if possible. And that's not good enough. When I'm on a motorcycle and everybody around me is doing 85, I got to go just a little bit faster to feel safe.
Yeah.
So the mentality is when you're commuting, you read traffic differently. It's not an obstacle, and it's not a game of Frogger. Someone brought up that, oh, maybe it's like Frogger. You're always looking for the gap, you know, how to fit into the gap. And to me, that's not easy. You don't even think about the gaps. You're looking so far ahead and kind of reading the ebb and flow of the traffic, and you're watching everybody's head, and you're watching everybody's front tires to see if they're going to come at you. You are so keyed into that, you don't even see the gap. Like, oh, there's a gap that opened up. You just kind of feel your way through, and it's a really, really nice mental state to get into. I enjoy commuting if it's not too hot and there's enough airflow that I'm not roasting in my protected gear.
Yeah, I agree. I actually also enjoy commuting. That's what I primarily do on my motorcycle, and it's a nice way to wake up in the morning and a nice way to wind down on the way home.
Absolutely.
Not to change the subject too abruptly, but I know that you have a later appointment this evening, and I'd like to get in a couple of questions that I had that I thought were cool. People send me in suggestions. They say, next time you talk to Liam, you got to ask him this. So I've been saving up a couple of them. And the first one, this is from Scott Jones. He actually sent me this email a couple of weeks ago, and he was listening to you talking last time, and we're talking about ranking the team's performances, and
I remember that with Jules.
Right, exactly, with Jules, and got to Konica Minolta. He started discussing Shinya Nakano. Basically, Scott's question is, why does Japan produce so few premier class riders given the country's huge contribution to motorcycle racing technology? And then he kind of goes on from there, but that's the sort of the short and sweet version of the question, and I know I didn't prep you on this one, so I hope you're...
No, this is a great question, because my personal take on it is that the best motorcycle racers develop their own. They develop before they even start competing. They start at a young age. The best American racers always seem to come from places where there's wide open spaces where you could just 2 o'clock, I finished school, I'm going to take my little RM80 or whatever little dirt bike they've got, and they can just go and let it rip, you know, and that's it. They just spend hours, days, weeks, years riding.
Uh-huh.
From such an early age, it becomes more than something they learn. It's more than a skill. It's like breathing. And you look at a country like Japan, where there's a lot more rules, sure, they have some wide-open spaces, but the mentality, it seems, in the country is not like, well, my son finished school at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm going to let him ride a dirt bike around and do whatever the heck he wants, because it's not like that over there. You do your homework after school. You know, you're not trying to plan to be some great motorcycle racer, whereas in the U.S., maybe you're not planning to be a great motorcycle racer either, but you're just riding around what you do. And
that's an interesting take. I like that. That's a good point. However, I'm going to rebut a little bit with there's always exceptions to every rule. I was going to say, what about we're seeing Japanese players in baseball, but again, you're not seeing overwhelming numbers, and it is that's a little different. So maybe my
True.
Point is kind of lame. But
I would also say that it seems like the riders that are forged in Japan if they're going to get into street bikes, they start on street bikes. You know, they start pocket bike racing. Then they're racing NSR50s or YSR50s. Then they move up through road racing. So that's all they know is road racing. And most of the riders in the U.S. that have gone to the international scene within the last decade or two decades, three decades even, did not grow up road racing. We grew up on the dirt. We grew up dirt tracking, flat tracking, motocross. That's our background. John Hopkins, phenomenal motocrosser. Colin Edwards, phenomenal motocrosser at an early age. Nicky Hayden. I mean, the Roberts clan grew up in the dirt. Everybody that comes from the U.S. grew up in the dirt. It's so bizarre for me to hear somebody that's never flat tracked a bike from the U.S. Same with Australia. What Australian grew up on the asphalt? None. They all come from the dirt, it seems.
Sure. Open countries, yeah. And then with a European sort of tradition, yeah, they have such a huge tradition of motorcycle riding that it's much more common for younger kids in Europe to...
Right, it's promoted by the family.
Promoted,
like,
there you go.
You seem to have an affinity for this, for two wheels?
Yeah.
We're going to get you on two wheels. And families in Europe, when they put themselves... Anybody in Europe, it seems, when they put themselves into a hobby, and maybe I wrote about this at one point, but it seems like, from what I've gathered, it's so hard to kind of have a luxury item, like a hobby, you know, that if they commit to, oh, I'm going to learn how to ride a BMX, they don't just use the BMX to truck back and forth between school and the 7-Eleven and the video game parlor. They're out there learning how to jump, learning how to balance, you know, learning all the little trial type stuff that they can do on their BMX. They become hardcore BMX types. That's one example. If they get into motorcycle riding, man, then the whole family gets behind it. And secondly, about Europe, they grow up riding two strokes, which is totally foreign to what we grew up on in the U.S. We're used to sliding through corners, steering with the back wheel, loose front. In Europe, they grow up with corner speed. And it's until you see it, you can't believe it. They all up the corner speed. You know, I've ridden with some people. I watch traffic. I've been on the back of scooters. And I'm thinking, well, all right, we're just on a scooter. We're going to putt to where we got to go. And all of a sudden, it's like somebody dropped a flag, and we are hightailing it through traffic in Barcelona, taking corners at speeds that I would just call ridiculous on a scooter two up. You know, whether or not it's a big scooter or not. Which they were flying, and I'm just thinking, holy shit. And it's normal. They're like, oh, we grew up on scooters. It's like walking. Scooters everywhere. So
yeah.
It's a nice way to bridge into motorcycling, competitive motorcycling.
So that's cool. Okay, so that's
Scott Jones is this, because I'll be honest, there are two Scott Jones that email with me, and one's got a really cute wife.
This is unfortunately not the Scott Jones that I've met, his wife, so I don't know what his wife looks like.
Anyway, if this is Scott that knows me, that had dinner with me, Monterey, your wife's cool.
Okay, I think it is that, Scott. All right, one other question, then I'm going to have to let you go, because like I said, I know you got an appointment, and I got to get back to work. And this one's from Rob Campbell, and Rob sent us a nice email. And this, I figured I'd pass this one on to you, because quite frankly, I don't know. Rob took a look at the New York Times article, and he was looking at the, that I mentioned last week, and he was looking at the bike pic, checking it out, and he has a question about the design. He says, the tail bike on the new RC212V looks like it's about half the size than it was last year. It just looks stubby. And last year's bike, and he says it's kind of an observation. He's wondering if you have any input about it, and are all the 800s like this, or is this just something that's kind of Honda specific?
Well, definitely it's Honda specific in the 800s. All the other 800s seem to have proper size tail sections for race bikes. As far as the Honda goes, it's the perfect design expression of mass centralization. The previous year on this, 5 years of the RC211V, you had an exhaust pipe that curled up and stuck out the back, so you needed to have a tail section that covered that. This year, the exhaust terminates and exits out of the belly pan you know, like a standard street bike, there's a fox bite that goes up underneath the seat, underneath the rider, and sticks out the back. So if you don't have anything back there, except the fuel tank, which is obviously sticking out out of the back of the Honda, and maybe a little bit of electronics in there, you really don't have any need to have a big tail section, except for aerodynamic purposes. Your top speed is benefited if you have a nice wasp-tailed looking tail section, which you'll see on the 250s and the 125s, where aerodynamic efficiency is really critical. You know, it's at a premium because they make less power. You want the wind to go over the windscreen, over the helmet, over the rider's back, and then you want it to go down over the tail section. You want it to be a nice, smooth line. That gives you the best top speed. But with the Honda, they put all their meat and potatoes as directly in the center of the bike as possible for the mass centralization. So there was no point to really have a big tail section other than top speed. Secondly, about having a big tail section, it's possible also, and I'm just throwing this out there because I haven't been in a wind tunnel, and I really am talking out of my butt after these Birra Moretti that I've been drinking. It's also possible that if you were behind a Honda with that tail-shaped design, it's possible that the wind, the flow coming off that bike, would make it more difficult to draft.
Oh, wow. That's a thought. Yeah.
It's possible. And I think if Honda thought they were coming out with the bike of 2007, they thought everybody would be behind them. And a lot of passing happens under the brakes at the end of a straightaway. Well, the only way you can pass under the brakes at the end of the straightaway is if you hung on in the guy's draft so that you were able to get that little extra bit to get past him before you got on the brakes. So it's possible they said, well, we'll just make this stumpy little tail section. No one will be able to draft us, and our riders are going to benefit. And then 2007 came along, and the Honda wasn't the one in front.
Right, right. But I can see. I mean, that's an excellent answer. It's awesome. I mean, and so much better than my initial thought of, well, it looks cool. So I appreciate that, and I'm sure that Rob does too as well. That's really cool, Liam.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun race, that's for sure. Wouldn't it be nice to wrap up the championship in Phillip Island in front of your friends and family?
Yeah, and I'm of the suspicion that that might happen personally. I don't know about you.
For me, it's bigger than that. I mean, I understand Casey Stoner's dream to be world champion. I kind of lived it vicariously for Nicky Hayden last year. Well, all the years he's been in GP.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I watch this kid because he's in the garage next to me, and I'm over there, so we speak. And I think for Ducati, it's an even bigger story. I mean, this is a manufacturer that's been building motorcycles for so long, but hasn't won. I mean, they've been making motorcycles for so long that to win this one, to beat all the Japanese, to bring the championship crown back to a European manufacturer since the 70s, it's huge. And the fact that I curse out some of the same people that built this bike when I'm frustrated with the bike, to me, that's extra cool to be able to say, oh my God, I can't believe these guys put together something that Casey Stoner won a championship on. It's a phenomenal feeling, even though I'm not on the factory team. And, you know, my feeling is I work with Ducati, and I'm part of that larger family of Ducati. And wow, you know, 2007. Could this be their year? And I'm not counting my chickens first, but it could be their year.
Yeah, it's kind of starting to look like it. It really is.
Never count your chickens before they're hatched. We're racing against the doctor.
Yes. And also we'll give them the commentator's jinx type of thing. I don't know if MotoGPOD is powerful enough to do the commentator's jinx. But whatever, Liam, it's been really cool talking to you. We're going to have to say goodbye for now. I'd like to talk to you again after Misano if you got it and you can fit it into your schedule.
Sure, sure. I just want to say a big shout-out to Ducati North America. Thanks for the hospitality and the generosity. It was really important for me, and I really appreciated it. And thanks to everybody out there in MotoGPOD land.
You know, thanks to you, too, Liam. We always appreciate having you on the show. So we will talk to you again real soon.
All right. Bye now.
It's always great having Liam on the show, and we always appreciate hearing from him, whether he's talking about MotoGP or his adventures with a borrowed Ducati or whatever. So thanks again, Liam.
That's going to do it for this week's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for downloading it. And again, at the risk of sounding sappy, like I talked about a little bit last week, I do want to say thank you very much for listening to the show, for donating to the show, for the emails, for all that sort of thing. MotoGPOD is it's a hobby for me, and the thing that keeps me going, that keeps driving it on, is the fact that I hear from the listeners, and I think that's really, really cool, and I'm glad you guys like it. It's gratifying on a lot of levels for me. I mean, there's an ego boost, a variety of different things. But in any event, thanks again for listening to the show. And don't forget the races this weekend. Misano, it's going to be on Speed TV, 1 o'clock Pacific time. Make sure you watch it. Or actually, better yet, if you have a MotoGP.com subscription, join us 5 a.m. Sunday morning. Or if you're watching the race live on Eurosport, whatever it is, join us. Go to MotoGPOD.com. On the left side, there's a link that says chat room. Jump on in there. Say hello. Whatever. Like I said, it might not be a whole big long free-for-all. I mean, we are watching a race after all. I'm not going to be spending a whole lot of time typing while I watch that race, but we'd like to hear from you. And if nothing else, you can sort of join in on the, wow, did you see that? And that sort of factor that we're going to be doing. So until next week, we will talk to you later, and make sure you keep the shiny side up and never forget one thing. There's two kinds of people in the world, those who are motorcycle riders and those who envy motorcycle riders. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.